think I did something wrong. Just a moment. But tonight I'm very happy to welcome for the first time to Many Rivers Books and Tea, Claire Drucker. Claire has published poems in numerous journals such as Phoebe, Control Burn, Diner, Epiphany, Puerto del Sol, Eclipse, and Women's Artist Datebook. Her first chapbook, Vortex, was published in 2008. Claire is a longtime English instructor at the Santa Rosa JC and a poet teacher with California Poets in the School. She also works as a writing coach and educational strategist for junior high and high school students. And today she is letting us in on her newest collection, The Fluid Body. Thank you very much for coming to Many Rivers. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being here. I feel like I'm surrounded by my friends and my family. And that feels really nice. So thank you. So intimate. So I'm going to read some poems from my book. And I'm going to explain some of the poems beforehand. I'm not going to explain the poems, but I'm going to give some background in terms of some of the history, and maybe also what motivated me to write some of them. And if you have any questions along the way, feel free to raise your hand. I'll also leave time at the end for questions. But if anything comes up, like why did you choose to do that, or you know, I was confused about that, or wow, I really like how you described that. Feel free to jump in and say it whenever you want to. And I'm so thrilled that I have my five kids. I feel like all of you are my kids. Yeah, so sometimes people say, how many kids do you have? And I have to think, I want to say like 20, but I probably say 5. So, and I actually came into my daughter's 8th grade class, and they're all from Gracie's 8th grade class at Sunridge, and I taught some creative writing classes, and so I'm really here. So the first poem I'm going to read relates to an event that happened when I was 11. My house was struck by lightning in one of those huge New York thunderstorms. If any of you have ever lived on the East Coast, also in the middle of the country, it was huge. We don't get them here, but those really huge kind of vibrating thunderstorms. And it was a defining moment in my childhood. Everything was talked about as AF or BF, before fire or after fire. So this is a poem that I wrote about that. It's called Long Island, 1974. I was 11, so you know exactly how old I am. So. 2 days before school, upstairs in bed, thunder vibrating the walls, air weighted, taut, the ribs a sounding board, floating, anything but fixed. The barely audible click, click, as if a watch were being wound backward. The tiny wheel catching itself in mid-turn, holding worlds between the stillness. On the first floor, my grandmother's urgent thrust through rooms yelled us down, a rare quickening in her voice. She who had been on her back for days, a lumbago attack, they called it. We ran, no time for robes. I just lost my spot. We ran, no time for robes, 1 foot bare, to a porch engulfed in hot, breathy licks like the R-rated movies I caught while babysitting before the parents came home. We stood in the kitchen next to its crackling beauty, mesmerized by its rising power, like a sun we wanted to touch but couldn't. It swallowed the room, beckoning all of us to enter it, to climb inside its fierce belly, its fiery orb of redemption, before my mother, with shaking hands, picked up the phone and dialed. So this other poem that I'm going to read next almost effectively came out whole. It needed very little revision, and it was my attempt to make sense of what happened to my life after this fire. My mother had been divorced when I was 4 and had been single with various kind of low-level boyfriends for about 10 years. And then this fire happened in our house, and we were having a lot of difficulty with the insurance adjuster, and my grandmother kept saying, you know, contact so-and-so across town. His house was struck by lightning, too. And she did, and he was married, but not happily, and there were sparks between them, and several years went by, and then he ended up becoming my stepfather, and he still is. He's there in Santa Rosa. He's 93 now. So the woman in this poem is my mother, and the man in this poem is my soon-to-be, 3 years later, stepfather. It's called Act of God. On a clear day in the early morning at the kitchen table, head cradled in her arms, a woman wept, wadded up tissues in her hands. Across town, a man went to work, his wife's words a suffocating slow crawl, following him to the store during dinner, after which he picked her up from the wheelchair, deposited her in her bed. Maybe Zeus, with his lightning bolt, thought, if not today, then when? For love to hit her electric box in September and explode into flame. For desire to strike his attic in July and incinerate the soup bowl etched with forget-me-nots, the blanket with the patch on the seam. Maybe it was the lilacs in bloom or the arc of the sun as it rode across the sky that made him feel wealthy, generous enough to throw his fire down to make both their houses burn. The woman met him to ask about insurance, noticed his eyes were dark as the sea. The man caught the smell of smoke on her clothes and liked it. When the Allstate adjuster came to the woman's charred door, cigar dangling, contract in hand, he pointed out next to cause the simple words, Act of God, so faint she had to roll them around inside her mouth to taste their singular jolt, to notice how small and still they were, yet weighted with a distant glow, a floating spark in that hollowed out room. Nervous. I don't know why I'm nervous.
That was a great poem, Claire.
Thank you. I'll have a sip of water. That'll make me feel better.
Claire, I have a question.
Yeah.
So what's it like to receive a poem in its totality like that?
What's it like to receive a poem in its totality? You know, it's like being given a really, really, really awesome birthday present. Like a present that you've always wanted but never got. You know, it's like, wow. It just, I think it's like for any creative, whatever it is that you do, music or painting or, you know, like when something is given to you that's so whole, it feels like a gift, really.
That come in a blinding flash, or did it evolve as you put pen to paper over it?
You know, I wrote that last year, and I think I had so many years to kind of let it gestate inside me that by the time it was ready to come out, it came out without any needing to really chew on it at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I've been instructed I can only read certain poems, certain mom poems. Here we go. have to read the book to get some of the others. So this is a poem about being a mom. It's called "It's in the Laundry." Okay, you can like cover your face, or you can here, need a book, you could cover your face. It's in the laundry. The legs of her jeans expand, seam to seam, as if turning around to memory, games of stone statue, I could almost glimpse the bangs and tiny knuckles, willows light against her back, pulsing her near me, still further into the open. Now her black sports bra, so empty, polished from use, lies on its own in the bed, the first purple of summer hanging musky from the stem. When I get to her socks, those fluorescent little numbers, I am trained, matching a mortal sin. Better to wrap curlers in your hair and put up your feet to watch the game if you want to enter the house. The icing of time shivers through last year's cutoff, hiccuping down too tight capris. I shake out my navy blue short sleeve she slept in and place it on her pile where it stares at something beyond my shoulder I cannot see, but which hovers, humming a small tune, entering the cavity behind the ribs where it throbs like a well-polished thought or a stone picked from the sand, warm from being held, no, struck by a word or a spoon. Thank you for letting me read that. That was what you said I could be. So this is an experience I had back in 1984. I was a junior in college. I was going to school in Charlottesville, Virginia, not the most progressive place in the world, and that's all I'll say about it. UVA Clinic, 1984. I am in college the week before finals. I eat donuts for breakfast, go to the student clinic for a yeast infection. I see an intern, maybe 26, round-faced, sandy-haired, small wire-rimmed glasses. Sexual intercourse? Yes. Contraception? No. Face red, meaty, like a good steak. He extols the virtues Margaret Sanger fought so hard to make available. Did you know a diaphragm with spermicidal gel is 94% effective for preventing? And I'm letting him revel in it, the fire in his eyes, like your jet red lips soft from tonguing you open. He's so new, he has baby fuzz on his chin, and I watch him rise on his knowledge throne with its velvet staff. If you want to avoid diseases, you have to use a condom and let almost nothing through, as if I can see the notes he's poured endless over, as if I can see the notes he's poured endless hours over in his dorm, half crazy with sleep, the tiny print swimming in front of his face, like small moans when I finger you home. But many women love the pill for its convenience, disappearing into a purse to pull out. He's like a lecturer at the podium who can't quite stop, even when the audience slides down in their seats and a few snores are heard from the back, when I reach over, press my fingers into his arm, leave my scarlet impression on his flesh. You don't understand. I sleep with women. And his mouth turns slack. Like those large freezer doors in the backs of restaurants, and a light sweat breaks out on the trembling lower lip, now devoid of color, eyes hitting the floor, unable again to meet mine. It makes me happy to know that that man will never do that again after that experience with me. Really. So. That was good. is a poem I wrote up at Donner Lake a few years ago. Totally different nature poem. Donner Lake. In the middle of the frozen lake, granite ice crystals, their thin, glistening petals, each vein a country waiting to be freed, each translucent reflection another flaming star. Beneath polished surface, time bubbles like delicate filigree, a rippled wave, dense yet fluid as this moment. Sky cobalt, cracking bones of water under our boots, sliding, loosening day into a mirror, a half open window revealing the blue lift horizon. Fresh and cold on the flushed cheek, feet slipping, we spin. Mountains, pine, ice, all suspended. Quiet and still as the body when it sleeps. A dream that when uttered slips through fingers like newly fallen snow. It's a very quiet poem. When I read it, it makes me very quiet. Like snow. Any questions? Soaking it in? So I have a twin sister. Most of you know that. And this is a poem that I wrote for her. She and I went on a rare camping trip together a few years ago, and this is the poem that came out. It's called Cross-Legged on the Sand. Singing to Yemaya, one voice, two ospreys, whales invisible but in the ribs, an echo lost in translation, emptying us. Both dressed in purple jackets, arms laced, we say, let's be twins, traveling backward toward the beginning, warm and thick honey on a spoon-dipped night, the moon a thumbnail, fire crackling where our hands touch the soft places we've carved into beds, her feet where my head is, as if floating suspends the sound of her small body, a cave, a whole night wrapping me, where nothing could taste that good, or flatten the timber of hovering waves, soothing choked back sobs. Inside some mystery, her heart takes the lead. Another minute, a feather reverses direction to gather my words into the forest, to cradle our bodies into giving themselves up. Nothing ever in between, so close. The song we carry each other through. As some of you know, being a twin is a really fabulous thing, and it's a very complex thing. It's okay, you can laugh. So, this poem came out of going through menopause a couple of years ago, and wow, what a ride. Wowza. It doesn't really stop, you know, it just, like, takes you with it, keeps taking you with it. What do I say about it? I think I'll just read the poem. This is called Seeds. From my palm, I slip a few white tears into small holes, cover them with a loam blanket. They are silky, made of almost something. I resist the urge to uncover them, shove five nothings where only one should go. Soon, a murmur the size of my pinky nail will become a sunny cucumber, round like a long vowel, loose with pricks and barbs. My own casings have hatched into nothing less. Words on a line, a decent cry, money in my pocket, a really excellent orgasm, another girlfriend, and once, only once, into a baby with eyes, nose, mouth, and eggs of her own. That happened. Now they are listening with their tiny ears, their unformed lips. They want to leap up and kiss me, thank me for the good times. But the truth is, they are tired, hungry. They want to rest, to follow in the footsteps of the carrot or beet, to launch a root into the voice of the soil, and sleep the sleep of the weary, a memory so quiet they do not know whether it is last year or not yet tomorrow. Sorry, you were in there too, I know. When I was teaching creative writing at the JC a few years ago, some of my students were writing rap poems, and I love rap poems because the rhythm is so great, but I really can't write rap poems. I just can't. You guys do awesome rap poems, but I just don't. Anyway, so this was my attempt. It's not a rap poem, but this was my attempt. It's called Holes in the Sky. Polar drip, fixed at a pill, shooted cold, this faucet in pieces, plastic, hospital, Rhode Island, med-surg, call the doctor for a new Pacific, what's the bygee dolphin got to do with, it's not my fault, these storms up to our arms, did you know only ancestral homes float, freeze me extinct as a golden toad, my middle name, cry, oh, genuflect, before the net, we were dumb, anything is more, is give me that Bluetooth to replace cancerous bicuspids. We can eye touch the ship spiraling down, smart pen recording the wails of the flailing, Twitter me faster, longer than the last condor, can Facebook holes in the Skype, a lifeboat of untold stories, fingers tapping Morse code to internal universe, drought, famine, not when I'm gaming, I can still blog my way out, my phone surgically implanted in the place my eyes used to be. I'm teaching critical thinking right now at the JC, and many of my students wrote papers on either benefits of technology or dangers of technology, and out of about 10 papers I've gotten, maybe two have actually written about the benefits, and when I say technology, they're writing about, you know, cell phones and laptops and social media. And many of them are pining to go back to an era that they never experienced, but which they're nostalgic for anyway. Mm-hmm.
Really
interesting.
That's really unusual.
Yeah. Well, they're 18 to 25 set.
Yes.
Yeah.
How did they know about that era to be pining for it?
Oh, well, they've been exposed to so much. So.
That's true.
Yeah. I don't think you guys are pining for that era, though, are you?
Well, I don't know. I think about it because, like, it affects my life so much, and there's so much to it that, like, is good and bad, that it's kind of like, it'd be a different experience to see a different time that wasn't, didn't happen much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you do, like, benefit from it, so that it can become addicting. So
it can become addicting, right.
You have to learn self-control.
Self-control is hard. So compelling. How many adults have self-control? Yeah, so hard. Yeah. Really hard. Am I doing on time? Oh, good. Okay. So I can read this one because my mother's not here.
You're sure?
I don't think so, unless she's hiding in the back there. So this is in my mother's voice, and I have fictionalized it somewhat. Not too much. And I'm going to do it in her accent. And she doesn't have as strong an accent as I'm going to do it, but I can't help it. She wasn't born in New York. She was born in Vienna, Austria. But she still has a strong New York accent. And some of you will recognize yourselves in this. It's called Bathroom Humor. How much rent do you pay there? That's outrageous. I know it's Sevastopol, but that shouldn't be allowed. Now, I have to ask you something. Sit down. I want you to ask your landlady to buy you a new toilet. Those stains in the bowl are just terrible. And you can tell her that your mother doesn't want to use it looking like that. Dee also mentioned how bad it looked, didn't you? Well, now he's quiet, pretending like he never said anything. But the last time we were over, he said something to me about it. Does she have a toilet that looks like that? I didn't think so. Now, I want you to tell her she has to replace it because I won't use it when I'm there. It's the least she can do for overcharging you every month. I don't come to your house that often, true? But what if I have to go and those stains are staring back at me? You wouldn't make your old mother crouch in the grass like a dog, would you? If I tried to squat, I'd never get up. You could just keep me there in the garden like one of those statues. Anyway, I just wish we could leave you some money when we die so you could buy yourself a decent one. You need a sugar daddy. It doesn't matter that you're a lesbian. What about N? Is she going to leave you anything? What kind of a relationship do you have with her anyway? Can't she pay you rent? Or give you a few thousand so you don't have to worry about buying a new toilet once in a while? The flowers she bought me are very nice. But there are too many dried ones. Those people at the market, they're not stupid, you know. I bought a lottery ticket, and if I win, I'll give it all to you and your sister. A mother wants to leave something for her daughters, something so they shouldn't struggle. Like when they need to buy new appliances, such as a toilet. They shouldn't have to worry about not eating. If only we hadn't taken that reverse mortgage out on the house. I had so many nice clothes, most of the tags still on, and we got nothing for them. I did so need those blouses and jackets. Buying those outfits made me happy. Who cares that I didn't wear them? I felt better knowing that I might wear them. They should have let my brain die last year. What kind of a life is this? I'm dizzy, and when I let go of the walker, I'm wobbly like a little lamb. How great, you made us sandwiches. It's so nice when you come over and do everything. Next time, cheer me up. Tell me you bought a new bowl. A new bowl I can sit on and not worry about what germs I might catch. I didn't show her that poem before I put it in the book. And then, you know, when it came out, I said, so did you read the poem about the toilet? And she said, oh, yeah. And I said, what'd you think? Oh, yeah. So I'm not sure, but luckily she's kind of not always there. Sometimes she's not, so I'm not sure if she actually got it. But that was good. Because I wish I could say I really made that up, or a lot of it, but really, no. Nancy's like, no, it's pretty accurate. It's mostly, yeah.
Is she talking about those stains from the minerals, like the iron stains?
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Every toilet
basketball. Yeah. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I mean, you know, you can get this.
How you doing? Did your mother come over?
No.
I do, actually. It's so funny. We got a new toilet, and it's so clean. You know, I called her right away. I was like, it's fine. You can come over and sit in the bowl now. But now it's building up, so I think she'll probably. You know.
Yeah, write more about that.
my next book hasn't actually, it hasn't started writing itself, but when I do, it's actually going to be about my grandfather. And so I've written quite a bit already in poetry form about him, because he was sort of a pivotal figure in shaping my family's story. So this is just one small attempt at trying to make sense of that piece of my history, and I'll give you a little sense of it. My mother and my uncle and my grandmother left Vienna, Austria in 1938 and came to New York, and they were able to, they came when the Nazis had already invaded Austria, and they were Jewish. And the only way that they were actually able to flee the country was that my grandfather sacrificed his life. He took his life in order to enable them to have their freedom. So it's a powerful story, and one that I've seems like putting it in poetic form has never quite done it justice. And so my thought is to actually devote a whole book to him. And he's coming to me in dreams. I dream about him, and also sometimes when I wake up in the morning, I feel his, I never knew him, of course, right? Died in 1938, and I was born in 63, but I feel him, and he's always kind of hovering around here, and I feel his insistence. I don't know if any of you have ever had that experience, but he's basically saying, listen, I didn't have a voice, but, you know, I need you to be my voice. And my sister has the same feeling, and she's been writing also, so she and I are kind of like, I'm going to do it. Anyway, we'll both end up doing it, because I think the story's worthy of more than one perspective. So this is a poem that I wrote, and it's dedicated to my grandfather. It's one of those things, and I think a lot of artists have this drive before they die, that there are certain things that they have to create before they leave the planet, and this story, basically telling his story, is one of my, you know, one of the needs that I have before I die. It's called Nine Angles of Escape. One, his sisters might have said consulate, quota, brown shirts on cobblestones, a singular rewind, this erased thought, a surface, a bell. Maps on teak table, wrinkled mountains, forgettable as Brazil, crisscross river plunge, next page. Three, L'chaim, raise a glass to yesterday, waiting the hand, small feet can't run to life. Four, whether time is a glance or a jar, airless in June, but not Australia during winter, docked boat starting over. Five. Legs take him back to Strozhenets, ghost fire, Russian rifles, smell of death in empty kitchen, only swinging door knows him. Six. U.S. borders thick, Romanians must walk on water. At night, the well of her back, a country under his touch, no visas. Seven. Every day, a century, evening sirens ring. Her tiny ears behind his eyes, love floods room with eiderdown. Eight. On the table, a note. Keys unhinge, rusted decision to bend gravity wider, last chance to save them. Nine. Oven dial beats a heart on his knees, prayers for a lifetime, forgiveness take his soul. I have a really, really strong relationship with this grandfather who I never met, and I actually knew my grandfather on my dad's side. He died when I was 11, and I had no relationship with him, but this grandfather that I have a very strong kinship with. It's amazing that you can have that kind of relationship with somebody you've never met. Yeah. How am I doing? I'm good. Questions? Mm-hmm. Thoughts? Anything?
Can you tell us how it has saved his family?
So, he was Romanian, and the quota system in terms of the United States opening their borders and setting quotas meant that if you were a woman, you were under your husband's quota. So she was considered Romanian, even though she was Austrian. The United States had closed their borders to Romanians at that time. And he was one of nine children, and unbeknownst to her, he had been researching what would happen if he was no longer around. And I give a little background. So, of course, they didn't know at this point that things were going to get as bad as they were, because how could anybody wrap themselves around, you know, that kind of persecution? So they waited and waited, and they talked about, you know, my grandmother described spreading the maps on the table and looking at, they could have gone to Australia, they could have gone to Cuba, they could have gone to Brazil, and he really didn't want to start over anywhere else. He had a really tough life already. He had fought in the First World War and almost died of diphtheria, and it's sort of unimaginable. His village in Romania had been burned down by the Russians countless times, and so starting over in a new country was just unfathomable to him. So he relied on his sisters, I think, and he started researching what would happen if he wasn't alive any longer, and which did not come to light. You know, I didn't actually know this for a long time. It was very secretive, because suicide, there's so much shame around suicide in our culture. So, but he found out that she would revert back to her Austrian status, and the United States was still letting Austrians into the country under the Austrian quota. And so after he died, she had a neighbor who was the wife of the consulate, and she went to the neighbor and on her hands and knees begged for a visa, and that's how they were able to get out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
An amazing story. Yeah. For my grandmother, of course, she felt incredibly abandoned, as you can imagine, even though it meant freedom and a new life and the ability to survive. But the sense of abandonment was really, really, of course, really strong. It's an interesting thing. I'm not sure if she really thought that he had researched, because the way it was presented to me when I was growing up was that he was so depressed and he felt really trapped and he didn't know what to do, and it was the only way he could respond to this terrible situation, because if they had stayed, they would have all perished in camps, because it was really late. The Nazis were pretty entrenched already in Austria. So if she had any inclination that this had been more premeditated on his part, that he had actually saved them, she didn't communicate that to me. I didn't find that out until I was in my 30s, when I started doing some research and poking around talking to more relatives. So, I mean, history is funny, because it depends on whose perspective you get it from, you know. So I think that's my next book, clearly. Knocking on the doors. So this is a poem that I wrote many years ago, actually. It's called Pacific White-Sided Dolphin. First night together, 13 years apart, and your girlfriend between us, we walk the stretch of Dillon Beach and see it. Milky eyeball, steel gray back, one dorsal fin, underbelly white as the moon. You roll up your khaki pants, drag it out by the tail, forearms taut, waist pounded by surf, bent on salvation. I don't remember anything more beautiful than this. But the lozenge of its body tumbles in, blood from the long, slender nose staining the foamy water, blowhole sucking at air like the wail of a mother. Shuka, shuka. And for a moment, there is only this pastel surf lit by the reddening sun when you lay your hands on its sleekness, kneel into the wet sand, head down, whispering, it's okay, you're not alone here. Crying. That's a coup d'etat. My student the other day in my class started crying, and she's like, oh my god, I'm so embarrassed. And I said, you mean I haven't cried in my class yet? Gosh, you know, I gotta bring some tissues in and make sure they do that before the end of the semester. Because I usually never get through a semester without tearing up, or I can't full out sob, because they'll freeze up and get totally embarrassed. But usually, there's never always some moments when I'm teaching that I get, you know, teary. And then that's great, because then that lets them get really teary. It's really great. I'm sure you've had that. Ina's probably gotten teary, hasn't she? Many times, yeah. She's like me in that way. Yeah. It's a good thing. It's really good. We need to see more people cry. Really. We do. You know why? Because our culture is too shut down. Any questions while I'm perusing what else to read here? Okay, so this is a poem invoking the rain, because so far we haven't had any. This one I wrote in our last good rainy season, which was 4 years ago. And reading it just makes me feel more rejuvenated from all that wonderful wet. It's called Another Turning. Softened by spring's caressing fingers, the young couple pushes columbine in the front yard. E piles dead leaves into the green bin. The new family out with their yappy dog, and the old man who drives the baby blue Cadillac, today clearing out branches from a Japanese tree his son is felling. Small brown mushrooms, like heads of school children, push out more California green. Mustard flowers sock the lungs with brazen yellow, hills slate and emerald behind cumulus candy clouds. Boots squishing through mud, the ones with the tiny paw prints of deer, raccoon, and possum. I find my favorite oak, the one with 13 arms bent to praise, and throw my body around her mossy trunk. She smells of earth and loam, dense cells pulsing life, head on my chest, one ear to one heart. Trees plant me deeper than any cry I have yet to utter. I kiss her rough bark, walk through a tunnel of sunlight, the other side of some doorway, up the road, where even now the dog doesn't bark, all the neighbors inside, and only my red rubber boots and the back and forth of my arms slice the brisk wind, turning the houses into silhouettes, their shadows settling around my neck, pulling me closer to some dark, moist undertow of this world. I just can't wait to wear my little red rubber boots again. I mean, I didn't take them out all winter. Not all last winter, and I don't think I took them out all the winter before. It's just not right. Maybe if I leave the boots out. It'll rain.
It's supposed to rain this Friday.
Is it? Maybe I'll get to wear. So I'll read one more. So I've been doing a lot of this, it seems, lately, caretaking elders. This poem I actually wrote when Nance's mother had had a stroke, and she was back in Illinois, and she was in the nursing home, and so it's called Circles. See how the daughter cleanses her mother's cracked mouth with lemon swabs, feeds her tiny bites of ice cream from a plastic spoon, as the mother unhinges her bra and places her nipple between the child's eager, open lips. Notice how she strokes her mother's arm with the tips of her fingers, rotates it slowly at the shoulder, whispering, "That's it, you can do it," as the mother holds her child's hands over her head and walks with her while she takes her first steps. Now she rolls the socks down her swollen ankles, applies cream to the cracked, dry veins above the shin, as the mother unwraps the diaper from the child's hips, undoes the pins from the wet cotton, wipes the skin clean. Watch how she arranges the soft blanket around her mother's wrinkled form, leans down to kiss her goodnight, pulls the metal cord on the overhead light, fading blue linoleum to gray. How in the half light of the room, the child sleeps with one hand against her cheek, the other on the white pillow, mouth open, lips moving as if speaking to God. I think I'll leave it there. Thank you so much. Do you have any questions or comments or anything? You all look like you've taken a hot tub. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you so much for having me.
Our pleasure.
And Jim wants to end by saying a few more things. So.
First of all, thank you. That was wonderful. I can tell that everybody enjoyed it, and I really appreciate you doing the reading here tonight.